So, sitting on my immediate left is Carl Cannon, the White House correspondent for the National Journal, followed by, on his left, Doug Schoen, who is founding partner of Penn, Schoen, and Berlin Associates, certainly one of the leading polling firms in this country. And then Priscilla Payton, who is the deputy managing editor of Time magazine, and James Bennett, who is the editor of The Atlantic. And last and lately, but here, Margaret Carlson, columnist for Bloomberg News and editor-at-large in Washington for The Week magazine. So give them a hand. Make them feel welcome. I'm going to ask Doug to get us started by giving us some numbers, giving us a snapshot of the race for the nominations, where we stand today.
Well, Terry, thank you. And let me just say that we could spend a very long time on the numbers, and what I'm going to try to do, as somebody who was a partner of Mark Penn, who's running Hillary's campaign or as chief strategist, but I'm not in the campaign. So what I'm going to try to do today is to give you a completely unbiased assessment based on the profusion and proliferation of polls that are being done. Let me start with the Democratic side, which is, I think, more straightforward. Hillary Clinton is clearly in the lead. She's running around 33, 34, 35% in the national polls that are being done. Barack Obama's around 22%, 23%. Al Gore, when he's included, is around 15%. John Edwards, around 12%. And since Obama's gotten the race and since Hillary's announced, I think it's fair to say that Hillary has slightly improved her situation and Obama has leveled off in the mid-20s. Edwards has probably dropped a little in the national polls. The but is that the national polls, as I think most of you probably know, don't really matter that much now, except insofar as they make a difference in terms of candidate stature, and that stature matters for fundraising, which we'll get to in a second when we talk about John McCain. The but in the process is the following. Two buts, as I see it. First, John Edwards' strategy is an Iowa-based strategy. He has got to win Iowa. In recent weeks, Hillary's come up a bit, but I think when Real Clear Politics averages the Iowa numbers, he still has a slight 1 or 2 point lead.
So for clarification, Doug, the numbers you first gave us are the national
numbers. Yes, yes,
yes. And now you're talking about Iowa.
And what Edwards would say is, look, and he has said through his spokespeople, look, national numbers are fine, but if I'm in the lead in Iowa, and that comes first, well, then I'm going to, you know, be in a position to be able to do what John Kerry did, which is conceivably run the table. And his scenario, just to be very brief, is that he wins Iowa, wins New Hampshire, does very well in the Nevada caucuses, and South Carolina, neighboring North Carolina, falls into line. And then the rest of the states on February 5th fall into place. Hillary Clinton's strategy would be something akin to winning in Iowa and thus really, because she's leading pretty much everywhere else, running the table herself. And I think Obama's strategy would be something akin to, I've got all this money, I've got all these donors. There's going to be an opposition or an alternative to Senator Clinton. There will be one. John Edwards will drop by the wayside. Al Gore's not going to run. And I will get in. I will become that alternative, and with my superior fundraising ability and my base, and the fact that I was right from the start on Iraq, I'll emerge. And Al Gore's strategy is that somebody somewhere's got to blow up for them to be room for him to emerge. I would say at this point, Hillary Clinton is the decided favorite in the Iowa futures market. She's about a 50-50 proposition, and I think that's a fair estimate. The Republican side, I think, is a bit more murky at this point. Rudy Giuliani is leading the national polls by, I guess, 6 or 7 points over Fred Thompson. Now, Fred Thompson is a blank slate, hasn't come in, is more of an actor now to most, or a district attorney in Manhattan, than he is a former Tennessee senator. He's now running 17, 18%. There was one poll this week actually had him ahead. I don't think he's ahead, but it's a sign of his momentum that he has clearly moved up from asterisk to 17 or 18%. Giuliani had been in the mid-30s. He's now in the mid-20s. He does well in large states like Florida, California, New Jersey, and New York, but they don't come till February 5th, and he's got to win somewhere, Iowa, and New Hampshire, South Carolina, for him to stay strong. The candidate who's probably doing best and is not on the national radar screen is probably Mitt Romney. And Romney is leading by about 7 or 8 points in Iowa and New Hampshire. If he wins Iowa convincingly and is then able to go on to win New Hampshire convincingly, I think given his appeal and the fact that the Republican Party clearly is facing a void, he has the possibility of emerging. His fundraising in the second quarter wasn't what it was in the first quarter. The but is more significant. His net worth is $350 to $500 million. It's not clear how much he'll spend. He's put $12 million in, and most candidates tend to put money in if they think it's a rational proposition. And from all accounts and all assessments, it is for him. The guy who I think is in most trouble now and might well even have to drop out is John McCain. I mean, he's down to $2 million in cash. His poll numbers are sinking precipitously. And it's hard to see how he can rekindle his campaign. To me, he has the worst of both worlds. Too close to Bush on Iraq, too far from the conservative base on immigration, and a sense that he's probably old and past his time. Now, the obvious question that Terry didn't ask, but I'll take 20 seconds to answer and then stop, is what about general elections? And two things about it. I looked at the numbers today. It's fascinating. There's a strong preference for a Democratic president, all other things being equal, because of antipathy to George Bush. Bush won't be on the ballot, but obviously his policies will be at issue. But when you look at the horse races between, say, Giuliani and Clinton and Giuliani and Barack Obama, what you see is, and even John McCain, what you see is those horse races are effectively tied. So we're in a situation where we can make some tentative judgment about the Democratic side, some even less tentative or more tentative judgments about the Republicans, and the general election, notwithstanding all that, is a dead heat. Terry, let me stop there.
That sets the stage for us. Margaret Carlson, we are in the middle now of what is conventionally known as the money primary. And in the money primary, with the numbers about to come out for the quarter, you see that Barack Obama is doing spectacularly well, raising the most on the Democratic side, and raising it from the largest number of individual contributors. Here's my question. Why doesn't that translate, then, into the polling numbers that Doug just summarized? In other words, why isn't that showing up?
Well, may I make an announcement first? If anybody's seen my driver's license, I have to get on a plane in the morning without it if I don't find it. So I've just been at the police station, and maybe they'll find it.
We'll all vouch for you.
Yeah, could you all come with me? The Pied Piper. Obama, he came on the scene. And he now looks to me, because of this, the fundraising, and I hate the fundraising primary. Why don't we have an issues primary instead of a money primary? Like Howard Dean. Like he has this internet persona. He has small donors. He has a wide swath of support. And in terms of money, people he can go back to, because most of the other candidates have tapped out their donors, so he can go back. And some of that which is not reflected in the polls. The second thing about Obama is that he was exciting at the beginning, and he seems to have tamped down some of that charisma and excitement on purpose. When I first saw him, he was you know, a dynamic speaker. The crowd was excited. He was all there. And now there's a reserve to Obama when he's out there. And it seems to me to be slightly calculated. Some people around him say he didn't want to run that kind of campaign. He didn't want to be a rock star. He wants to be a serious guy. It's like, well, be serious later, you know. This is not the time to be serious. This is the time to get people excited and passionate about your candidacy. Maybe the steady as you go is gonna work for Obama. Maybe he's storing it up and it's all gonna come out. We think it's late because we've been watching an awfully long time. It's actually early. There's time. So that's my analysis of Obama.
James Bennett, we're already really into the thick of it in this campaign, let me ask you a question about the coverage. Will the public be better informed as a result of this very early start and this deep involvement?
I'd like to, if I could, first, Terry, I'll come back to that before we talk about the press. If we could talk about the pollsters for a second, Doug, if I could come back to you. And it's sort of an unfair question to ask a pollster, but how seriously do you think we really should take the numbers at this point in the campaign? This relates to what Terry just asked me. Particularly, polling in Iowa is always a tricky proposition.
Yeah. Here's a very, very good question. Here's what I would say. It's not quite right to just say the national numbers don't matter, because people in Iowa do live in the United States of America, and they get the national news. So if John Edwards comes down nationally, it's going to hurt him in Iowa. And similarly, if Hillary Clinton is perceived as the consensus frontrunner, it helps her, and I think she's benefiting from her. At the same time, what Margaret is saying is, I think, very, very important. There are sort of two or three phases to a campaign, and we're in a long phase one. People, I think, in the fall will start their first serious look at the candidates. And as if you go back to Iowa in 2004, you know, Dean came down, there was a Gephardt period, and then, you know, there was John Kerry's emergence. So to my way of thinking, I think you want to take them, the numbers seriously, and if you're John McCain, you take them very seriously. But I don't think they're dispositive by any means. At the same time, it's very hard to ignore them, because if you ignore them, at your peril.
And for the news media, I think it's much the same, in that we're paying a great deal of attention to this, partly on the assumption that people really want to read this stuff this far out. Everybody has geared up completely for this campaign. The major news organizations have all made their assignments, even their body assignments to individual candidates. We at The Atlantic started writing about the candidates 2 years ago. We had a Mitt Romney profile, and we delivered ourselves of our big Hillary Clinton piece in November. Which is a great piece. If you didn't read it at the time, it was an evaluation of her Senate career and whether it had positioned herself, how it had substantively prepared her, whether it had substantively prepared her for the presidency.
So you delivered that piece in November of 2006.
Two years
prior to the election.
Yes, and part of the thinking was that she already had received so much attention. I mean, all of us up here have written, with the exception of Doug, multiple profiles of Hillary ourselves over the years and for assorted publications. And this particular period of her life hadn't been received the same sort of scrutiny. A monthly magazine with our deadlines, the long cycles that we have, we wanted to get out ahead. Now, we may have gotten so far out ahead that I'm not sure how much people were paying attention.
But we have the same problem, which is that the campaign, as Doug suggests, hasn't really started for real people. We're not, this group here isn't really the example of, we're more tuned in than more people. And time has already put Romney, Hillary, Obama, and even Bloomberg and Schwarzenegger on the cover. So, you know, we're over. It's you know, you'll have to look it up on Nexus, you know, if you want to get more informed. But it's the same sort of anticipation of a campaign that I think real voters haven't quite clued into.
Carl Cannon, can you hold out any hope that the public will be better informed as a result of this early start?
Well, you know, this thing's going to be over so fast, they better be paying attention now, because next year it's going to be like that. It's going to be 6 weeks. The first person goes to the polls in Iowa, 6 weeks later you'll have a nominee. So we all feel that acutely, and that's one of the reasons Priscilla and James are being self-deprecating, but we have to cover this now, because now is when there's not much time. This is July. It's going to go. Summer will be over, then the fall will start. And, you know, last time you had this, going into Iowa, you had three candidates. We didn't know who was going to win, Dean and Edwards and Kerry. Kerry won. They pretty much finished that way around the track the rest of the time. We were thinking, okay, now it starts. Well, it was over.
Yeah.
And so I think the media understands we've got to cover this now. The question is, will people read it now? And I don't know the answer.
All right. Let's.
But the public, the public will be as informed as it wants to be, I guess, is the answer, because the stories are out there and they have more tools to get the information than they ever have. So it's kind of up to them.
Can I say one?
Please do.
That reminds me of something. Doug knows I respect his work, and in fact, everybody here I'm a fan of, and sometimes why am I up here? But I'll tell you this much. I don't necessarily think Hillary Clinton's ahead of Barack Obama. That's one measurement. That's a horse race poll nationally, and it starts with a lie. If the election were held today, who would you vote for? Well, people mm-hmm. know that's a lie, mm-hmm. so they're gaming us a little bit. Now, how do we know we're gaming us? Because this is not 1936 when the phone rings and you answer the party phone and you say in your farm, "Ma, it's George Gallup. Are we still with Roosevelt?" "Yes, we're Roosevelt people." And everybody in the party line said, "Amen, we are too." It's not like that. People call it, they know how these polls are used, and I can prove this to you. James and I covered the White House when Bill Clinton was accused, it turns out credibly, of having a liaison that he shouldn't have been having with the White House intern. His poll numbers, Clinton had a historic number in the low to mid-50s. At that point, it was actually a little high for him, around 58%. You could look this up, and please email me if I'm wrong and call me names. I'm so used to that. But it was about 58, I want to say, 57. Well, it immediately went to 66. Immediately.
An incredible day.
Yes.
For
now, I submit to you that two-thirds of the American people don't really think you're doing a good job because you've had sex with an intern. They may think you're doing a good job in spite of that. And that is what the American people... And that number was the same, and it stayed the same till the moment he left office, and it was the same for all the related questions. Should he be impeached? Two-thirds against. Is he doing a good job? Yes, two-thirds for. After he was impeached, should he be convicted? Two-thirds against. The American public did not want him removed for this, and they tried to tell us... Well, they tried to tell Henry Hyde. He wasn't listening. Some of us were listening. Margaret was listening. We got where this was. And so they understand how polls are used.
Right?
Carl, you're making an argument that the polls now are pretty good predictors.
What I'm
saying, because they're pretty stable. Let me finish.
Yeah, sorry.
And what I would say is the following, and to move away from 1998 and move to current America. The real challenge that Barack Obama and John Edwards face is there is a dynamic in place that is working to Hillary Clinton's benefit. She's ahead in every state, 31 of 32 states. February 5th, we're going to have 18, 19 primaries. She's well ahead, 15, 20 points, bigger than her national numbers. And for that to be dislodged, in my judgment, one of two things has to happen. What Margaret is speaking of and what James is speaking of has to happen. There has to be a real change in the dynamic and how people look at the candidates, or alternatively, in Iowa, there has to be sort of a special campaign of the type that happened last time, where the dynamic changes, and as you said, it was over before it started. If that happens, well, one of those two scenarios happens, the national numbers will change. However, if Hillary is able to get through Iowa with, you know, either a narrow loss, a narrow win, or a muddle, I think it's more likely than not that she'll get through South Carolina, Nevada, New Hampshire, and then go into February 5th with a fundraising and political base that makes it tough, not impossible, but tough to assail her. And the reason why I stopped you, Carl, on your point was when public opinion gets locked in, as it did on impeachment, really tough to change it. We're right to say that it's not locked in, but on the Democratic side, I'm making the argument that it's closer to being locked in than it is on the Republican side.
But I was really talking about a journalism thing. And what I'm trying to say is that it's not our job to predict the winner this far out. It's our job to
My job.
Yeah, fine. And you're down. And if you're right, we'll go to the racetrack.
Yeah, right. You did your job, Doug.
But there are other things that we take into account and are supposed to. And one of them, all right, you got the poll. That's my all right, how about the... Another thing we need to take into account is the money. For a person to be unknown in this country 2 years ago and to be raising the kind of money that Senator Obama is raising now, it's unheard of.
Except for Howard Dean. Well, except that there's a difference with Howard Dean.
All right,
Howard Dean inaugurated the era of small donorship. But Barack Obama, I think, this week, with his 248,000 donors, small donors, I think has inaugurated the era of small money. You know, Hillary was supposed to win this election with a sort of Bush-like, you know, tank-like, you know, move through the big, you know, her version of the big donor Bush approach. And what we have, actually, and this is good news for American democracy, is not just a small donor program, but a truly viral program where people are doing stuff like putting up their own web pages to raise money for them by on their own inventing contests like, let's give money according to our height. You know, if you're 5'2", it's $50 per foot. And it's that kind of sort of citizenry. Now, everybody says, well, this we showed with Howard Dean that this goes away. But I think that there's a big difference 4 years out between the Howard Dean sort of grassroots campaign and this and Barack's.
Right. One thing up to this point, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No.
One thing up to this point, none of you has mentioned the so-called second or even third tier candidates in this process, which is still very early. You're not even talking about the Joe Bidens or the Chris Dodds. You're not talking about the Sam Brownbacks and others. So are we to assume, all of us here, that you simply expect these people to fall by the wayside or think they already have?
I think Biden is running for Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. I think his performance in, I guess it was the last debate, at least in my terms, confirmed that. I think Bill Richardson is running for president and vice president simultaneously, and I think his performance has confirmed that. And
Dodd is running for treasury.
He may well be. But I think Priscilla is making a point that, Terry, if I can, I want to pick up on, which is she's absolutely right, and this conversation we're having tonight is illustrative of my point. There is a vast disconnect between us, the political class, and ordinary people. And what I talked about in my poll presentation today, briefly, is a profound disjunction. People are really angry and pissed off with politics. They're pissed off with foreign policy, domestic policy, and they're doing precisely what Priscilla is saying. They're saying, you know what, we got to get involved. Terry, there's something else we didn't mention, and you can blame the pollsters all you want, but Margaret alluded to it, which is issues. We're 17 months out, and we're talking polls and handicapping and fundraising and gamesmanship, and nobody is talking about issues. And if we had an issue primary, I can tell you the American people would be a lot more happy. The fact that I get the attention I do as a pollster is, I think, unhealthy.
But just to circle back a little bit to what Carl said before, and maybe it is a degree of humility, believe it or not, on the part of the press about not wanting to predict the future, and also a degree of longing for change, which is the kind of fuel for our business. But I'd actually vault past the second-tier candidates to the no-tier candidates and past the small donor to the single donor candidate and ask, isn't it possible somebody else could get into this race and totally scramble the picture that we have now? I mean, I listened to your presentation today. I was sitting with my brother, and we had the same reaction, which is, Sounds like a great opportunity for a Mayor Bloomberg or somebody who's not on the scene to get in and present themselves.
I've done an Aspen primary, and you know who won? I mean, an election. Bloomberg won in Aspen. Yeah. Of the people here, because there's
just in the days of the festival the, he's here.
Yeah, my 4-day election, because there is this longing, and it's sort of romantic, and we always like it, and then it never happens. But this time, it looks like it could be, because there's not just dissatisfaction on the Republican side, which we all know about, but there's a little bit that, okay, Hillary's this giant, you know, tank rolling along. Do we really want that to happen? Isn't there something else? And Doug, you know, the idea, I think we want to get on the Democratic side, like the press wants two people. We want the drama of two people. So we want it. We want to ignore these other people down there so that like the debates can be better for us because we can have two people. Because as long as you have all those people, you can't concentrate on the people that you think you need to learn about because it's too diffuse. So we'd like a Hillary Obama. We'd like a Romney Thompson. There's a desire to fast forward to that point.
Let me respond, Margaret, to yours and James' point. Putting Mike Bloomberg aside, taking him at his word, as I do, that he's not going to run, I think in terms of public opinion, there is a restiveness. And the way I would respond to it, let's take John McCain for an example. Let's assume instead of him being on this seemingly fruitless mission he's on, 6 months ago he said, you know what, I've had it with this. You know what I think of Bush. You know what I think of how he's handled the war. I'd handle it differently. And you know what I think about immigration. I do that differently too. You know the kind of, you know my history. I've done things that most people haven't done. I talk straight. So I'm going to run as an independent, with me, without me. I think the reservoir of support he would have tapped would have been pretty substantial. I think that if there is a loser on the Democratic or Republican side who does what I'm describing hypothetically, there will, again, potentially be a reservoir of support. I think the problem, though, is that the system presents significant impediments to doing it. So consequently, we have what Priscilla described, which is a lot of people in the middle and on the extremes who are just plain angry. And in the presentation I did this afternoon, what I think I was trying to say was people on the right are pissed off that we haven't succeeded with what they thought were good and reasonable goals, and people on the left are pissed off because we haven't succeeded what they thought was an absolutely outrageous and foolish mission. Taken all together, you've got a populace that 70-80% is just really angry with the arrangements as they exist.
Carl Cannon, Margaret touched on something, which is the tendency of journalists, news organizations perhaps, to search for a sort of narrative in a campaign, to begin to portray it in a way that you can follow the progress of either individual candidates or the issues and the debates. You said the desire for a bipolar situation, a couple of people running against each other. I mean, are these the same patterns that we certainly have seen in past elections being repeated this time?
Yes, but with one exception. And that exception is Senator Barack Obama. This has never happened before. And I called my father, who covered politics for many years. Susie knew him. He's still around. I said, have you ever seen anything like this? He says, oh, yeah. Jack Kennedy, I've seen this. Mm-hmm. And what you have now is a person who's so exciting. Margaret and I usually agree, but I don't agree with her. He's going out and tampering. You know, he's trying to sound presidential. But this is a guy who's ignited passions in a way I've not seen. Now, listen, if you think I'm shilling for the guy, you can. I noticed the other day somebody Googled me, and Hillary Clinton comes up. If you Google my name, Carl Cannon, what'll come up is Why Not Hillary? And it's a piece I wrote for Washington Monthly. I shouldn't say this with my boss sitting here, but Paul Glastris called me. He's the editor of that small magazine, even smaller than ours, and said, listen, I got this idea. I want to do this great cover. I want one, Hillary should win, can run. You know, she's it. And the other is, you know, and she should never run, and she's terrible for the Democrats, can't win. She'll ruin it for us. And I got 15 people want to do the second piece, but nobody wants to do the first, and your name keeps coming up. I said, well, Paul, I can't do that piece for you. I'd have to do it for my own magazine. But I'll tell you this. Hillary Clinton is the next president of the United States. He said, oh, please, you must do this story. Please, please. And I said, well, I don't want to see a grown man cry. I'll do it. And I did it, and you can read it, and it's subversive on about three levels. I compare it to Reagan, which she didn't really like. But anyway, but I explained, you know, when you have the when you have a person with 100% name ID, can raise the most money, has the base, has the operators, they're all Hillary people. You know, that they did this thing at Shorenstein, and they came with Bill Richardson's people and Brock's people and Edwards' people. They're all Clinton people. They all worked in the White House. So this is the person. It's the establishment person. It's a woman. She's got the money. She got the name. And but wait a minute. One thing I didn't see, and that was Barack Obama. That's what I didn't foresee. And this for this guy to come out, remember, this is 2004. He gives a speech. He's a state senator. He now raised $31 million in a quarter. I'm sorry. This is an exciting thing. We all ought to we ought to look at it and
Terry,
be not so jaded.
You know, the press is often accused of sort of creating narratives, you know, out of sort of self-entertainment or because, you know, they're failed novelists and they really want to be, you know. But the fact is the American voting public wants a narrative. That is how they make judgments about the character of the people who run for office. And conflict is a very, very healthy part of understanding, you know, the character of the people involved. And if Barack Obama shows some of the elbow that he's shown vis-a-vis Hillary, that will tell us a lot about him. If McCain runs a campaign where he hires every last consultant in the Western Hemisphere and
that's
drains money.
That's not always bad.
Yeah, it's bad. That tells us
depending
a lot about him. You know, these are, you know, tomorrow's Washington Post has a story about how, well, it turns out Edwards didn't have only one $400 haircut. He had 4 years' worth, and one of them was $1,200, and he had the guy fly out. People say, well, you're trivial to focus on this, but everything sort of builds into a narrative that we have to have in order to understand these people.
Let me ask Margaret to pick up on that theme and talk about covering Hillary Clinton and the way in which that may be different, in the sense that here we have the first woman coming, at least leading as a favorite towards the nomination, and the first former first lady, and she is right this week campaigning with her husband. In Iowa, the first time in the campaign that they're appearing together. So this is different, is it not?
Yeah, this is so different. Can I just add something? When all of you are leaving here and go to the airport, which I hope I'm doing, Men's Vogue, take a look at it. It's on the newsstand. On the cover is John Edwards posing in his $400 haircut. Whoever on his staff said that was a good idea, given what, you know, part of his narrative, he's defined by the big house and the hedge fund and the $400 haircut, you'd think he just wouldn't do that. Hillary, she's so different. Who would have thought that she'd be the first lady to leave the White House to go run for the Senate in a state she'd only visited as a tourist? Now we say, well, of course she did. But, you know, that was huge. And now the wife of a president is now running for president. It's brand new. So voters have several, you know, it's not just the first woman to run, it's the first former first lady to run. That's a lot to swallow. And then, you know, what we haven't brought up is, yes, she's leading, but she has very high negatives. So not everybody knows Obama or knows everything about him. 99%, would you say, Doug, know Hillary Clinton, know an awful lot about her. And is it about 50% who are totally opposed to her? She has, you know, very high negatives. So I think one of the reasons she's in Iowa with Bill Clinton, which wasn't in the plan, is that, you know, maybe she's not doing as well as her campaign thought she would be doing by then. Because when she's with Bill Clinton, yes, he is, you know, hugely popular. By contrast, she doesn't look as good. She just doesn't, he's gifted. He's just absolutely gifted. And she's She's got a lot of good things about her, and I imagine that that piece about her in the Senate, she's been a really good senator. But she's no Bill Clinton, and when they're together, that shows. And I saw a clip of it. I'm in a news blackout here because I haven't seen any television news, but I did see a little snippet of them. And she was nodding. Now, you never want the president nodding.
Doug, I wonder what you think of that, and I wonder if you think these high negatives that Margaret is talking about, or the concerns about Senator Obama, explain the continued question, will Al Gore get into this race later in the race? Is this just nostalgia for 2000, or what is it?
Well, you've asked Terry three questions. First, Hillary and her negative. Second, whither or where goes Barack? And third, where goes Al? And they're in a lot of ways related. So let me try to be brief. Hillary clearly does have negatives that are high. I think those negatives are high among non-primary voting voters, Republicans, independents. So I don't think it's a problem for in the primaries, but it sure is a problem in the general election. It is mitigated by the fact that she is going to try to make the election about change and about George Bush and his failings and try to invoke the generic preference of the electorate for a Democrat and keep focus off Hillary Clinton, yes or no. So that I think is the brief answer to that. On Obama, what our conversation has really not focused in on, and it ties into your question about Gore, is what Mario Cuomo called the rationale. So far, Barack Obama's rationale is, vote for me, I've got a great personal story, or I'm attractive. I don't think there's anyone in this room, I certainly can't, tell you what Barack Obama's going to do as president, how he's going to lead America in a way that is different from Senator Clinton or Senator Edwards. I mean, we might have a few nuances about health care and who was right from the start on Iraq, but I don't have a sense as to what his, quote, vision is or direction. And I think that explains, Priscilla, why he's raising money but not building broader levels of support. The problem I see for Al Gore is if Hillary's got about a third locked up and Barack's got about 22-23% locked up, that's half the electorate. John Edwards, notwithstanding whether it's $400 or $1,200 haircuts, has got 10 or 12%. And Terry's right. There's another six or seven candidates who've got 10 or 12 points between them. That doesn't leave much room. Now, maybe if Al Gore gets the Nobel Prize, and maybe if John Edwards sinks, there'll be some room. But if you're Al Gore, do you want to get into a race you're going to lose and devalue your franchise when you're arguably at a level internationally that is so prominent that losing is more than just losing? My guess is that he doesn't get in because there isn't an opening, not that he doesn't get in because he doesn't want to get in. I think he does want to get in.
Priscilla, do you agree with that?
The thing that surprises me about the Al Gore numbers is that despite the fact that he's become sort of the apostle for the 21st century and turns out to have been right about everything, his negatives are very high. And they're very high. I mean, I looked into this recently because we did a poll about religion and politics, and we were trying to get to the bottom of this. And it's the same syndrome that Hillary suffers from, which is, you know, simple association with the Bill Clinton administration. And you would think, given how much Al personally dislikes Hillary and has misgivings about the last campaign, that people would understand and give him some distance from it. But voters don't see it that way. And so, to me, that's the biggest liability for him.
I don't think Gore is going to get in, because if he lost to Hillary, he'd kill himself. it would be unbearable.
Well, I think that's
the
what
history
Doug
of the Clinton thing.
Suggesting that the downside
the history
is
of the
just
Clinton
too,
is just too great to bear.
Now, let's talk briefly on the Republican side. A recent poll suggested, this was in the New York Times last week, looking at the opinions of younger Americans between 17 and 29, And they were asked whether they thought the country was ready to vote for a woman. And the answer of the majority was yes. Was the country ready to vote for an African American for president? Again, the majority of this group polled said yes. Question, was the country ready or is the country ready to vote for a Mormon for president? Answer of the majority, no. This amazed me, and I wonder what any of you think as to how big a problem this is for Mitt Romney, and if so, how does he deal with it? In 1960, John Kennedy famously dealt with the Catholic issue by addressing it directly, by going to a meeting of bishops in Dallas, as I recall, and directly addressing
Protestant
it.
Ministers.
Yep. Protestant ministers? Forgive me. So how, if you're Mitt Romney and polls suggest that this is a problem with at least some sector of the American electorate, how do you address it? James?
I'm going to pass on that one. I don't know the answer.
I don't know the answer either, but I, the one thing that puzzles me a little bit is the answers he's given so far, which is, well, we all have the same values. Brand should matter. The one,
the answers that Mitt Romney
has
given.
Yeah, that's what he's given in the last two, 3 weeks.
And also, I've been married to the same wife.
Right. Which, you know, frankly, when it comes to labels, you know, in the Republican religious vote, brand does matter. And so making the argument that it doesn't, I don't think gives you a whole lot of traction, even though it's spiritually satisfying to say it.
Carl?
I have a slightly different view of that, Terry. I think that we in the press need to be very careful on this question. All of us have been approached by either our secular liberal friends or Democratic friends, and they have a version of it, and it goes like this. You know, evangelicals won't go vote for this guy. And you know it's a cult, right? And you need to parse that, because it works about three different levels, and they're all bad. The first is, Democrats don't, most of these people don't know any evangelicals. How do they presume to speak for evangelicals? Secondly, they don't like them. They've been denouncing them for years and said that they've given the country over to fascists, so I don't think they really should be speaking for them. And the third thing is, it's a rank prejudice. They're imparting this, and it's, you know, it's like this kind of macabre push-pull that they're doing with their friends. And it's offensive to me, and I've just endeavored personally to not let them get away with it and not write about it like that. I think Mitt Romney, he stands or falls on his merits, but if anybody who holds his religion against him, I don't really want them reading my copy.
I think most people would agree with that, and yet I found the results, as reported in the poll, quite incredible and striking. Doug, did you?
Well, let me speak as a political consultant for a second. First, I think that since his father did not face the problem in, I guess it was 1968, mm-hmm. My answer would be the media has been talking about Mormonism. People don't know that much, so hence it's become a problem. What I would tell him is if it appears to be retarding his ability to get votes in the primaries, which so far it hasn't, or more likely, Terry, in the general election if he's the nominee, he'll have to do a 2008 equivalent of what Jack Kennedy did in 1960. And almost certainly he will, and he will, you know, say he's like everybody else. He believes in, you know, one God and one wife, and go from there, and talk about separation of church and state, and talk about his values, and say that let's put aside these prejudices and go forward. And I think it will be partially, but not completely, successful, because the media won't let it be successful.
Because let me ask all of you to pose a question if you would care to. To the panel, got some bright lights. I see a hand here and a hand here. And one right here as well. And so you have microphones that you can deliver. Let's start back here.
Hi, I'm Ben Alterman, a Bezos scholar. You guys are speaking about Obama, Clinton, and Gore separately. What would happen if two of them decided to get together after the primaries? What would happen there? Because, like Clinton and Obama, they each have completely different pulls in places. Like Obama's got so much minority, and Clinton has such a different pull. What happens when if something like that happens? Is it likely? Is it plausible?
Margaret?
Two senators, not traditionally a good idea. You know, the first woman, the first black together, you know, that would be, you know, a first for that. And did I say something?
I'll tell you later.
Somehow I don't think you're enamored by this idea. James? Would it or would it,
having
would it be a
on
powerful
one question
ticket?
Already, I guess I should address this one. I don't think we can know. I'm sorry. I think it's way too early to make that determination. And we don't know how either of these candidates are going to wear on the stage for the next 12 months. I do think, and we haven't talked about this, skipping over to your questions, which I'd prefer to address, is that it's going to be really interesting to watch this very long general election campaign. And I'm sort of hopeful that that could be a really good thing, that we're going to watch whoever, there may be less of a winnowing process in the primaries, although I doubt it given how much money they're raising and how hard they're running already. And then we're really going to see them for a long period of time preparing themselves rhetorically and hopefully substantively to actually be president of the United States.
And
part
actually
of that is
going to
be
issues.
Picking a running mate. And my colleague John Roush argues in the current Atlantic that the result may actually of this long campaign may be something closer to a British system in which they're actually putting shadow governments together. And we're actually going to be able to judge these candidates based on not just who their vice presidents will be, but whether Joe Biden is going to be the Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. And we may wind up, this is, and we may not, but we may wind up with a much more clear, concrete sense of how they'd perform in office.
Mm-hmm. Carl?
I just want to answer the question on the basis it was asked, because I sort of agree
You're
with this premise.
Man.
I think if Hillary Clinton, let's say, prevailed in the nominees the way I infer Doug thinks she will, and Barack Obama finished second all the way through, I think there's pressure on her to choose him, and I think she has to, at that point, say why, at least offer it to him. And I think she has to say, if she doesn't, why she didn't. And I think there's a pressure that built in. If you know, we've all covered conventions, if you know the Democratic caucus, if you know the convention goers, there'll be a lot of sentiment for that. And I can see it happening, and I actually agree. I think it would be a powerful ticket.
We have a question here.
Hi. Doug Lawrence again from J.P. Morgan. We've lost three major religious leaders the last 2 years. The Christian right seems to be fragmented, fractured. What impact will that have on the 2008 election?
I think a very good question. I think I've written a book where I try to address that issue, and I suggest that there's a huge opportunity for the Democrats to make significant inroads with people of faith. And I think one of the profound mistakes that the Democrats have made since the Clinton campaign of 96, which I participated in and Priscilla was kind enough to write about, is that the Democrats haven't really reached out. And given the alienation of some Christian conservatives and evangelicals towards the Bush administration, if the Democrats are able to reach out both on issues and in terms of values to Christian conservatives, I think that there is a chance to have breakthroughs in states that arguably are problematic. I think it's a huge opportunity this year, one that we saw the beginnings of possibilities in the 2006 midterm election, and I think it's something that in forums like this usually doesn't get discussed to the detriment of the Democratic Party.
I totally agree, and I think the big untold story of the campaign so far has been the two-year effort by the Democratic Party, led by Nancy Pelosi, of all people, and Howard Dean, to secretly reach out to voters of faith who are not allied with the Republican Party. And I think that that difference will show itself in places like Michigan, where a lot of voters have said to the Democratic Party, you know, don't faith voters, don't count us out. Why do you? why have you shown open hostility in the past? I think the message has been received by the Democrats, and it's going to make a difference.
Okay. Kind of depressed at how quickly you've dismissed the third-party possibility. I understand logistically, and maybe it's Electoral College, maybe I don't understand, but given that all these people in America are angry and do want something else, isn't that sort of anti our whole democratic process and why people drop out and don't vote? I mean, here we have an opportunity, maybe, with Bloomberg to make it happen. So is it just the logistics of the Electoral College or what?
Well, I guess what I would say is it certainly is, I think, theoretically possible for a third party to emerge. I think there are three or four problems. First are the impediments the system presents in terms of just getting on the ballot, organizing a campaign. Second, I think the Electoral College is a problem. And third is, frankly, history, because the argument you get from the professionals is, well, it's never happened before. Well, you raise your hands quite legitimately, and I think the whole essence of what Priscilla and I were saying before is, because it hasn't happened before doesn't mean it can't happen now. I think that was Margaret's point as well. I really think the real answer to your question, ma'am, is we just have to wait and see what happens. Because as intelligent and thoughtful as I think our panel has been, we just really don't know what's going to happen. And I think really tune in next February and you'll get a sense as to whether your concerns are realized in the real world.
You can hear the hunger in this audience for a discussion, at least among the candidates, if not us, of the substantive issues that face this country. That's no surprise, and you're not alone. That range anywhere from the war to Social Security to the projection of American power abroad to problems here at home. When in this process, this incredibly long process that, Carl, you say will be over in the blink of an eye once it actually formally begins, when do we get to that?
Maybe the debates shrink to fewer people.
But you know, in defense of the candidates, several of them have put out elaborate health care plans. Some of them have explained themselves elaborately on Iraq, down to, you know, which battalion should be posted in Agbar province. And, I mean, you know, the substance is out there because I think all voters, and some of them already have bestsellers. If you want to read about their biographies starting at age zero, you can do that in two volumes. I mean, the substance is there. I don't think we've lacked it, and I don't think...
Are news organizations giving it adequate coverage?
I think so, because I think the one message that... the voters have sent this time, and it's something that Rahm Emanuel said earlier today at 2002 was supposed to be a serious election, you know, and then 9/11 happened. Well, one message that's come through, I think, from voters is we're in a very serious mood. And I think that's been reflected in newsrooms across the country.
I think that's demonstrably true. Can we have another question or two, and then we're coming to the end of our time?
Yeah, we talked about the change.
Trying to get a mic over here. Well,
we talked about the changing dynamics of the primary. For example, California, on January 9th, 3 million absentee ballots are going to hit 2 weeks before the Iowa primary. Do we really think that Iowa and the dynamic we've seen in the past is going to play out in the same way, or is it going to be sort of like we don't know what's going to happen?
Well, I'd stipulate that, that we don't know what's going to happen. But what about the first part of the question?
Well, the first part of the question is, I think that the California ballots that hit January 9th will almost certainly break the way the statewide opinion polls are suggesting that day. And if the current polls are reflected then, barring some tremendous change, that will be a big advantage for Senator Clinton. The second part of your question, after we stipulate that we really don't know what'll happen, but if there's some breakthrough in Iowa, if Barack Obama emerges in that second or third look, or John Edwards recovers from being on the cover of Men's Vogue, that could, you know, affect, obviously, tremendously, what happens after January 9th, which really means that Terry was ultimately right. We just don't know until we see what happens.
Well, I'll stipulate now that neither James nor Doug nor I spend $400 on our haircuts.
That's obvious.
I don't know.
Terry. Yes.
I don't know.
Terry. Terry. Terry, can I ask a question about the role of the press?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, here in the back. I'd like to ask
sorry, I can't see.
A question about the role in the press, including several friends of mine up there.
No.
Well, I'm going to ask it honestly, because the press has done a wonderful job covering the Bush administration, obviously, over the last 6 or 7 years. Not at all.
Got it.
And tonight's discussion has all been about horse races, polls, et cetera. So I actually ask all of you as legitimate journalists, when are you guys going to look at your role in covering the issues and giving us a legitimate discussion of those issues as opposed to what we've gotten over the last 6 or 7 years covering the Bush White House and the, for the most part, the discussion of tonight's election.
Let me defend the press.
Are we going to do single payer?
No. There's not. You made a minor comment about covering issues, but no one has said one issue about the
issues. You've asked your question. Let me defend the press.
Fine. You're a pollster.
Well, I also am a writer, and I try to think about these things, too. You look at where President Bush stands in the polls. Clearly, if you went to the White House, he would not be overheard talking about how wonderful the press has been to him. His ratings are at record lows. People have good reasons for those low ratings, which are due to the reporting by our press of conditions that I think the vast majority of us in this room find regrettable at the very least. So I think there's been reporting about President Bush and the impact of his policies. I think what we are all seeking tonight is that there be a full and robust discussion and debate of the candidates and issues facing us. What the press doesn't do, and knowing each of my colleagues separately, is they do their very best to put their own issue concerns and preferences aside to try to cover the news. I think we have here four of the best in Washington people I'm proud to call friends and colleagues, and I think that the fact that they don't have an agenda is one of the reasons we have a strong democratic system that makes pollsters important.
And Margaret, you were making a point earlier that it's hard to get into detailed discussions of positions on issues when you have so many candidates.
Right.
So does it have to wait for a winnowing process?
Yeah. I'd add one thing to what Doug said. I think after 01, the press stepped back a little from its traditional role of always hammering, always questioning, and 01 affected how the press covered the Bush administration for a period of time. On the issues, if we were to discuss the differences between the different health plans, which get pretty technical pretty quickly, single payer, universal, everybody's insured, everybody's not. Already I'm boring myself to tears. I don't know how many of you would follow it or be interested in it. It's all there to see. There's every major newspaper, magazine prints it, and the candidates certainly put it out. But that we're not discussing it doesn't mean we don't think it's important, but this isn't particularly the forum to do it. And I think everybody will have all the issues they want by the time they're voting. I mean, I do agree, we you know, in the press, we tend to like the race, you know, because that's what changes, it moves, we do it. We're like kids at a volleyball game, you know, where you never stay in your own position, you just go where the ball is. So we'll be talking about McCain because he doesn't have the money, it looks like maybe he could drop out, what's going to happen with him. There's the narrative grips us. But I just say that we couldn't do energy policy, we couldn't decide when the troops are going to come home, candidate by candidate here, and in part because are there 18 of them altogether? And I mean, I don't even know at the moment.
Yeah, Bloomberg and Newt.
I'd also say, Jim, I didn't mean to be flip, but some of us are kids at the volleyball game. Some of us are reporters in Iraq who are risking their lives and are telling you what the issues are there. They're covering the Middle East. They're covering the energy. They're covering energy. They're covering immigration. Now, there's a problem in the media whether we're continuing to invest enough in that kind of coverage. But I don't think you can fairly argue that serious news organizations aren't grappling with the most important issues facing the country. Now, how is that going to be translated into coverage of the political campaign? There are responsible people, and we don't always get this right by a long shot, and we're all too obsessed with the horse race and all the rest of it. Some of that is market-driven. People are interested in that stuff, and there's a place for it. There's also a place for talking about what we call the issues over and over again. What do we mean by that? Is a candidate's character also an issue? I would argue that it is. I think you're going to see a chastened press making much more of an effort this time around, partly because we feel more acutely that we're living in serious times than we did, say, in the 2000 campaign.
But I would also add one thing, which is, you know, the McCain deflation, it has had nothing to do with haircuts or anything trivial. It has had to do with issues, and those are the issues that we covered. His position on immigration, I would argue, was a principled one. He stuck with it. It was unpopular. He suffers. His position on the war, which everybody wrote about, was also a principled one. The public doesn't agree with it. He is now basically, possibly by the fall, on the verge of being forced to drop out. Those are directly linked to his positions on the issues, which we have described at great length. You could argue, you know, that perhaps he should have changed his mind. He should have, you know, followed the public on this. He didn't. That was his choice. But this does not happen in a vacuum. The horse race exists because there are people who take positions that are unpopular.
All right, we'll take one more question, and then I can see Doug's yawning here. I think it's a very bad sign when the...
Thank you.
It's because we started talking about issues.
She brought a single pair. It's murder.
We're clearly keeping Doug up, but go ahead.
I certainly don't want to keep Doug up. I think, and certainly been confirmed tonight, that the conventional wisdom now is that the American electorate is ready for a re-election, which deals with substance, which deals with issues. The question I have for all of you as seasoned Washington types is what you think the odds are, once we have finally chosen the two candidates, that we will have a real election that will deal with substance and issues, or whether it will degenerate into Swift boats and illegitimate children and $1,200 haircuts,
you know, and
the stuff that the Karl Roves and his Democratic equivalents of the world.
That's a great question, and enough to keep me awake another few minutes. and I let me start it off by giving what is not an equivocal answer, but it'll sound that way. I think we're going to have both. I think the electorate is going to demand a discussion of issues, and I think there's going to be so much time between when the nominees are picked and when people vote, and so much money in the process, that you're going to have multiple attacks back and forth. What Priscilla said is exactly right. Conflict is a way that people sort things out. Negative campaigns are used because they work. So I think we're going to have a participatory process that will be unlike anything we've seen before, combined with sharp elbows in a way that equally defy... past experience.
I think that's a certainty that the era of hard-knuckle politics is not over, but that this already is a serious election over the most serious issues that I think we can imagine. I invite you to give the panel a hand, and thank you very much.